The monster is dead, but at great cost. Olsen and McAllister took their teams on ahead of us. The plan was for them to approach the Hyperion and use the beam rifle to destroy all the external cameras and sensors. This was achieved. From our hiding place in the woods east of the ship, we could just make out the beam rifle's high-pitched rasp. Soon after came Olsen's signal for us to advance. Shouldering our equipment, Ferguson and I broke cover and jogged across to the tilted immensity of the Hyperion. The ship is leaning to starboard by about 20 degrees, and while the churned-up ground is still charred from the landing 10 days ago, a few green shoots are visible. Ferguson went first up the steep 100-foot incline of the ship's hull to where a large asymmetric superstructure juts to port. This is the Hyperion's hyperspace drive. Clambering onto the housing, we quickly found the emergency venting hatch just yards from the 30-foot-high hyperdrive stabilizer vane. Luck was with us. The vent was open, popped by system burnouts during the crash landing. With the equipment bags lashed to our waists, we climbed into the vent shaft, Ferguson going first. That vent is an emergency backup in the event of an overheat in the gas coolant system, and the shaft goes down to a valve manifold. Our real destination, however, was the main power coupling, which is in a part of the ship protected by armored hatches controlled by the command AI. Vichkov's map shows where the vent shaft passes by a crawl space leading to an air duct which serves Engineering Deck 9 and the power coupling room. We were about 20 meters down the shaft, using a laser cutter to slice through a side panel, when we heard a loud boom from somewhere in the ship. The shaft shook, but we held on to our positions. When I turned off the cutter, we could just make out the sound of gunfire, as well as the structural creaks and groans of the broken ship. Unable to risk radio comms, we had no way of knowing that Olsen and McAllister had just walked into a trap rigged to explode. After an uncertain pause, we resumed cutting. Minutes later, the panel came loose, and we were through to the crawl space. We squirmed along, over and past pipes and conduits, until we reached the air duct. Fortune was with us. It had a nice big inspection cover with twist-lock catches. Soon, we were crawling torchlit into the square-sided duct, hauling the equipment bags after us. It was difficult not to make any noise. The alloy panels bent and flexed audibly as we moved along, and dragging the bags made a harsh scraping sound. We could no longer hear any gunfire by the time we reached the grilled vent in the bulkhead of the power coupling room. It was dim in there, emergency lamps glowing among the shadows of the cabinets. Ferguson loosed the catches, then, still holding the vent cover, stealthily stepped down onto a console housing, then down onto the floor. It seemed that apart from a faint machinery hum, all was quiet. As I followed with the bags, I saw two motionless forms lying at the other end of the room. Directly to my right was the entrance, an armored hatch with a small window. Out in the badly lit corridor, another body sat slumped against the bulkhead. But they were not dead.